Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journeys.
It means that we run a business in a responsible manner. That business is focused on doing social good for our customers. It's very important to us that we have good, strong, durable products. So, number one, they're durable. Number two, they meet the cooking needs of the consumer, that voice of the customer, the passion to deliver success, and that they aspire to own these.
I'm very pleased to welcome Ron Bills, CEO of EnviroFit, a global social enterprise that develops innovative smart cook stoves designed to reduce smoke and CO2 emissions, enable families to live healthier lives while reducing climate change and increasing clean energy initiatives. Since the company was set up in 2003, it has grown to a global organization serving over 5 million people with over a dozen products and regional headquarters in East Africa, West Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Thank you very much, Ron, for taking the time to speak today to Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you've been a social entrepreneur probably before people talked about social entrepreneurs.
Yes, absolutely.
You did, yes. What is your vision? What does social business mean for you?
Well, to me, it means that we run a business in a responsible manner, but that business is focused on doing social good for our customers. And, you know, I remember back when I went to my first Skoll World Forum, probably about 2006 or 2007, and 2006, I believe, and the word social entrepreneur didn't even exist. What we did at EnviroFit is develop the business based on the principle of a for-profit business, that we had to make payroll, we had to take care of our customers, we had to have great product that people wanted to own. And we developed the business along those lines, but focused totally on energy access and clean technology cooking.
So in a sense, it's the mission of the business. That's what gives for you this particular, the social entrepreneurship, the fact that you have this goal to change the way poor people, I guess, in the developing world access energy.
That's correct. Absolutely.
Right. So where did you get this initial idea from?
Well, you know, we had started EnviroFit as a kind of a spinoff idea out of Colorado State University. And with the idea that we could take ideas born at the university or born within a company, and we could use modern engineering principles, modern running of a business, but drive that business towards doing social good. And in our case, access to energy. And we started the business doing two-stroke retrofit kits of dirty two-stroke engines in Southeast Asia and expanded that into clean cook stoves in about 2007. And that's kind of the genesis of the company.
Right. So what's at stake here? We talk about clean stoves. What is the scale of the problem and what does your solution offer?
Sure. Let me just set the stage for you. The World Health Organization estimates that about 4.3 million people die every year as a result of breathing smoke over time. So when you think about that, that's a higher deaths than tuberculosis, AIDS, and malaria combined. So it's a huge problem in the world. And what that's caused from is that about half the world's population had to wake up today and light a fire to cook with. So wood, charcoal, cow dung, agricultural waste. Wherein, you know, in the developing world, we get up and, you know, wonder whether we're going to roll into Starbucks and get a coffee or a meal or pop something into the microwave, and it doesn't work that way. And in a lot of the developing world, in Africa, Asia, Latin America, it's wood, and people are getting up to light a fire. So that's a huge problem across the globe, and people cooking on dirty fires means that they're breathing smoke and their deforestation rates and climate change and things of that nature. So a clean cook stove, such as our EnviroFit stoves, reduce the amount of indoor air pollution by over 80% or up to 100% when you have a chimneyed product. So the it's a huge reduction in emissions inside a home or outside, and it also reduces the amount of fuel use by about 60 to 80%. So the deforestation, the pressure on our forests are reduced. So huge reductions in carbon monoxide outputs.
That is a tremendous problem and very exciting solution. I guess the first thing one thinks about is the cost implications of that, in the sense that bringing in bits of firewood and old rubbish to burn is a pretty straightforward, low cost or zero cost option for many of the poorest people in the world who don't have money to spend on high tech or develop technology solutions. Did you see that as a problem at the beginning, and how have you approached that?
Yeah, certainly. That's a really good question, Virgil. And the affordability is always an issue. Our stoves are what we would may consider to be very affordable at, $30 to $40. But to a lot of people, that's a whole lot of money. But the interesting thing is, in the world where people are either gathering firewood or buying charcoal, that savings of over 60% can mean a lot to their lives. It can mean, I'll give you an example. In the charcoal world, just a 50% savings can be a huge number. A lot of places of the world, they spend about $1 a day on charcoal. So being able to save 50 cents a day when, your income may be $5 to $7 to $10 a day, that's a huge savings. I always go out into the field and visit people that have had our stoves over time. And I recently visited a family in Kenya who saved, they were charcoal stove and they've had it for over a year. And the lady and the gentleman in the home were very excited about it. And I always offer to buy it back, and how much did they pay for it? And they just loved the stove. And they told me that they were able to save enough money from the savings in charcoal that they were able to send their youngest, or their, excuse me, their oldest son to high school. And it's the first, and pay the high school fees. It's the first time that anybody in their family's got to go to high school. So a clean technology cook stove can be a life-changing event, not only from the cleanliness and the health aspects, but also in the money and the time savings. To where instead of gathering wood, they can be spending time with their children, or productive time with earning wages. So the stoves, albeit $30 to $40 on the average stove, there's also areas where micro lending comes into effect. So people that can't afford that $30, $40 cash outlay immediately have the opportunity to purchase a stove on installments through a microfinance organization or a bank where they do microloans. So there's always an avenue for availability of purchase for various individuals and demographics.
Right. So what kind of proportion of your sales would be supported by debt of one kind or another?
I would guess that's a good question. I'd guess probably around 50% would be a product that goes through some type of a loan mechanism to individuals.
Right. So that means that 50% are actually able to put together the money to buy a stove in these conditions, which is quite impressive, because there are all kinds of challenges about savings, I know, and just putting together those kinds of sums of money.
Sure, you bet it is. And type of a layaway type programs are popular, as well as people just saving until they do have the money. There's also self-help groups and women's groups that rotate their purchases between members, and so there's various very unique methods for purchasing products like ours.
That's great. It's great. I know that microfinance has had some highs and some lows, and there are in some situations it hasn't always worked out. How has that worked out for you in terms of the lending side of your operations? Are people keeping up to date in payments, and is that all working?
We partner with various MFI organizations, generally, strong, good quality, reputable MFIs that work within the communities. And I've never heard of any struggles on repayments. People have always been very, very conscientious of their debt.
Great. Tell me a little bit about how you approach marketing this in rural environments, in very different environments from the ones in which we're, you know, accustomed to urban, industrial, and so forth.
Sure. You know, it varies a little bit depending upon, you know, different geographies in the world. I mean, we have operations in India, East Africa, West Africa, Mexico, Central America, and South America. So it's a little bit different, but the basics are that it's got to be people have to have awareness and they have to have trust and belief in the product. So the strongest marketing is word of mouth. And, you know, within these regions, I mean, EnviroFit has about 500 employees, and 490 of those are dispersed within across the geographies where we work. We have about 12 people in the United States, and the rest are in those geographies I mentioned: India, East Africa, West Africa, Mexico, Central America, Latin America. So those people on the ground, you know, are the local people, and they're doing direct marketing sales where they're doing demonstrations at festival seasons or in various markets, or we're working with distribution partners and training them through our online EnviroFit University on about the products and how they work. And we have some local language flyers, and flyers are a big avenue for reaching people, and where they take that flyer home and look at it and they've seen a demo, and then they save their money or contact their dealer or distributor or us to purchase a product. Sometimes it's even radio and television advertisements in local communities.
Great. You make it sound like a smoothly operating, and I'm sure it is, machine. And you've been at this for quite a while. There must be been considerable challenges on the way to, you know, building up this network and developing these specific sales techniques, which you now know work. Can you talk a little bit about when you set out at the beginning and when you know, how did you think about your initial attempts at marketing and maybe some of the lessons on this journey?
Yeah, that's some good questions there too. I think, you know, it always hasn't. It isn't easy and it's not perfect. And one of the, you know, I guess the biggest lessons learned is from us is that if it doesn't work, try something else and keep working it. But the main issue was around really understanding the voice of the customer. And we are extremely passionate about our customer and our business. And we even operate a customer care operations within each one of our business units. And that's basically a call center. And we're following up with every customer to assure the customer satisfaction and any questions on usage. And, you know, within the world, cell phone penetration is growing and growing. So most people, it becomes easier and easier to be able to converse. But, you know, I guess the basic lesson of, you know, you may think it's a great product and it works great in the lab and you like it. But the real answer is whether the people that are using it like it. And we've spent a lot of time in the field, a lot of time working with focus groups and teams in the field to really develop product that people have a passion to own. And that's probably the biggest takeaway that I have, is I see a lot of products that come into the developing world that people think are great, but the users just don't like it, or they don't work, or it doesn't cook the right meals, or doesn't do the food properly. So truly understanding your customer is probably the biggest lesson learned that we've had over the last decade.
That's fascinating. Sounds like very good advice. Now, you talked about this initially being developed as a spin out at the university. How has the technology developed since then? Because as you say, this was an idea, presumably developed in isolation, maybe a technology breakthrough, and you've emphasized now the closeness that you have with consumers and users. Can you talk a little bit about how the technology's changed over the time?
When we originally started in India with a product, we didn't even know how we were going to make the combustion chamber, because most of the stoves had a ceramic, you know, a clay-fired combustion, and that really isn't scalable on a mass production. And so we really developed this technology over a long period of time, and developed a combustion chamber and some proprietary alloys that enabled us to superheat these gases and clean emissions and evolve the models. Envirofit doesn't have just one stove. We have a whole line of stoves, from individual household wood stoves or individual household charcoal stoves, a couple different models each within those categories. And then we have commercial products for feeding, 300 children in a school a day, and in a very clean institutional stove that a 100-liter pot that could feed 300 children for meals and save 80% in fuel. So, which is a big savings to schools. And then we have a plancha stove in Latin America for where the traditional cooking is with, tortilla-based type cooking and has removable pot rings to sink a pot. So what we've done is taken the basics around a passion of developing the cleanest burning biomass stoves available to man and developing that technology into packages that people want to and aspire to own that produce the normal type cooking that they're used to and the type of foods that they cook.
That's great. That's great. Now, you talk about this being technologically advanced. That's terribly important. But I wonder, as far as the end user is concerned, and this may sound like a naive question, but in a sense, I won't say anything's better than what they have at the moment. But there are, I guess, multiple different possibilities that are better than they have at the moment. How important is it that your technology is the best?
Well, yeah, I think it's very important to us that we have, good, strong, durable products. So, number one, they're durable. Number two, they meet the cooking needs of the consumer, that voice of the customer, the passion to deliver success, and they aspire to own these. And then we look at it as a cooking, as a ladder, right? You have wood, you have charcoal, and in some cases there's also opportunities for LPG, where people, if they can afford LPG, and that's like a propane tank for your barbecue grill. So the LPG tanks are somewhat available in certain parts of the world, and we also have a program. We have some LPG stoves, and we also have a program to expand our LPG penetration. But that's getting into where people are having to pay for on a regular basis the cooking fuel, and like they do in charcoal. So helping to expand the LPG market is also one of our goals as we look at this as an energy ladder.
Great. That's great. And can you talk a little bit about financing and how that's been for you and maybe some of the lessons? I mean, you've talked about the time it took in a way to develop the technology and to understand the best way to develop it and so forth. How long was it before you had revenues? How did you finance the whole thing?
Envirofit, we started out as a nonprofit organization when we were doing two-stroke engine retrofits. And in retrospect, that was probably the wrong business model to approach, because the as a nonprofit, you're kind of taxed with the difficulties of raising money, and it all has to be donor-based, whereas our business model was more around a social enterprise. So we converted from a nonprofit to a for-profit enterprise to be able to enable us to be able to take on debt, which as a nonprofit, it's very difficult to do. So as a for-profit business, but then we have to show that the business makes sense, that we have that we run a good P&L, we've got a strong balance sheet, that we really have customers that are paying. And so with the growth of Envirofit, it's been a blend of initially some grant funding to help support getting the business moving in the right trajectory and develop the segment that didn't exist in the world in clean technology cooking. And then as we evolve the business, and we'll do close to probably about $30 million in revenue this year. And as we grow that business, then the needs for working capital come into effect for us to... From the time we buy raw materials to the time we deliver finished goods, there's a cash need there. And then once those finished goods are sold, then we receive revenue. So so we were able to obtain a business loan of about $4 million recently that enables us to help manage that working capital. And we were also able to raise some equity within the business to strengthen our balance sheet, which is what, you know, a bank or a reputable lender would look for in a business. It's the business has to make sense, and then we have to be able to repay the money and manage the business in a proper manner.
That sounds great. That sounds great. I guess the early days are the most difficult. I mean, you mentioned grant finance. Did that get you to a stage where you were making reasonable revenues, or did you need to look at other avenues?
No, that got us to, you know, to the stage where we're making decent revenues. Now the difference between revenues and profits are where the issues can lie. And some of it is driven, you know, self-driven within the business as to what are your aspirations to grow. You know, with Envirofit, we have a broad geography. I mean, we're in East Africa and all those countries, you know, Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Uganda. And then in West Africa, we have the Francophone countries, plus, you know, Nigeria and Ghana, which we have manufacturing bases in. And then you get to Central America. So we're in Mexico and Peru. So we have a broad geography. So we have a lot of investment growth. So as we grow within a geography, it takes some time to get the revenues and the operations up and running. But that's where we're at today is with those embedded operations. So we're very proud of it.
That sounds great. Can you talk a little bit about scaling? Because clearly that's been something you've been thinking about from the beginning, I'm presuming from some of the things you've said. Can you talk about how you thought about scaling at the beginning and how important it has been and some of the decisions that you have made as a result of that or looking at through that lens?
You know, you think about scale in the clean cookstoves business, and population growth. So you look at, you know, population growth and scale. So a small operations within one country or one village, or it may be an interesting idea and be very helpful for that, you know, the local geography. But in the true sense of deforestation, climate change, you know, carbon monoxide reductions, health impacts, that's pretty small numbers. And, you know, you can get to the point where your population growth would outrun your scaling effects. So what we look at is building a business on a foundation that can truly scale and make an impact in the clean technology world, clean technology cookstove world. And so we set this up to be able to, you know, manufacture at scale and to be able, and that's not running the business on a back of a, you know, on a back of a napkin or on an Excel spreadsheet. That's proper business systems. Like we use NetSuite as a business enterprise system within our company, and really developing the ability for the business to scale and then scaling it. And that's where you'll get the lowest cost, the highest quality, the best people, best products.
That's great. That's great. Now, when you talk about scaling, it seems on one level, I guess, pretty straightforward. But I'm just wondering, how difficult are the decisions that you need to make at the beginning to get scaling right? I mean, were there some decisions, some options which were really important at the early stages that you did things in a way that maybe another organization might not if it was not so focused on scaling?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you know, when you really begin the business and you look at it, you have to decide where you really want this business to be in the next 5 years or the next 10 years. Because a lot of those decisions along the way, you know, how you manage finances, how you build a balance sheet, how you run your P&L, the business decisions around enterprise software, manufacturing decisions of where am I building, where am I buying, you know, how do I globally source the highest quality, lowest costs, you know, raw materials. Those decisions are very important because it's a lot different if you're trying to run just a small business, you know, making a small scale impact in a local community versus saying, I want to have a global business that can make an impact to the world.
A lot of decisions there. Are there one or two that you look back on that you think they were really crucial?
Well, I think going back to that, you know, how do I originally form the business? Is it a nonprofit, a for-profit? What's the business basis so you can grow? And how do you take on debt? How do you responsibly grow your balance sheet and manage your P&L and your debt equity ratios? There's a lot of small decisions along the route that need to be made, because otherwise to scale a business that hasn't thought about it, you might not have the right people in place. You might not have the right business systems or the right banking relationships or the right business acumen to really, really grow and scale a business beyond a individual community.
I mean, you talk about managing your balance sheet and taking on debt. What kinds of things come into play there?
Well, the basics of before, it's just like if any individual goes down to a bank to borrow money, there has to be credit worthiness of the individual. So as a business, that's the way banks look at it as well. You know, what is your proven track record? Are you responsibly managing your human resources? Do you have the potential for growth? Do you have a track record that shows that you're making money and able to deliver products on time? A lot of places in the world, it's about truly delivering your product and delivering what you say. How do you deliver, 10,000 of something a month versus 10,000 of something a year? There's a big difference in the way the business is set up.
I guess execution counts a lot there, and
Yeah.
that can be
Yeah.
something that's quite difficult to executions, everything, I guess, in business, but in a mainstream conventional profit making, Western business where they have the infrastructure and everything's in place, it's a less significant hurdle than if you're working in, Africa with poor infrastructure, no communication or poor communication and other things. How have you approached that?
Getting the right people in the right seats of the bus. And, we have just using, since you've mentioned Africa, East Africa, we've got a gentleman that runs East Africa operations, David Small. And David spent many years in Colgate. He's Zimbabwean by birth, lives in Nairobi, runs East Africa. And he's a master at leading a team and growing a team and growing an organization. And has the same passion that we all do around growing and managing the business. So, it's really about getting the right people on the team and focusing in the local market areas. Somebody that lives somewhere else coming in to tell other people how to, that doesn't work. What works is having people that understand the local community and the difficulties and the challenges and the opportunities to really develop the business, and with the backbone of some really great product and some really great engineering and manufacturing behind it to grow it.
Great. It's a great story, Ron, and a great success. Have there been a couple of moments where you wondered whether it was all going to work? I mean, what's been the most difficult moment for you?
I don't think I ever had a moment where I wondered if it was work. It was I'm not the most patient guy in the world, so sometimes I just wanted more results faster, but always had a belief in the team and the people. And every time I look in one of our customers' eyes and I hear the story, it just recharges my batteries fully.
Finally, I guess just looking to the future, what is your vision over what time frame are you looking and what do you want to achieve?
I'd like to see us, quadruple our business within the next 5 years, and I think that we can do that very responsibly as we bring on our full operations in the countries I've mentioned, and then also as we look to the growth of the LPG and how we play a role in delivering LPG to that last mile distribution.
Great. And any advice for other ambitious social entrepreneurs that want to take on a big problem and make a big difference?
Make smart decisions and never give up.
Good, but I guess challenging advice too. Thank you so much, Ron, for taking the time today and sharing your adventure, your lessons, and your experience. And I wish you the very best of success.
Thank you very much, Virgil. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.